At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
All right, guys, here we go.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News.
Well, hello again. It hasn't been long. We just actually talked to each other because we just went through a pivotal and historic presidential debate just a few days ago that continues to make news, and we'll continue to talk about it here on Smarter News. But we start off this week with breaking news from the Supreme Court on the American presidency, no less. And the ruling today, or the decision, I should say, today, will have impact for years to come. The question about what that impact will be is TBD. And this is a Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity. How protected is the U.S. president from criminal prosecution anyways? Right? We've never seen a U.S. president or a former U.S. president criminally prosecuted. This is the first time in American history. And that obviously centers around a case or cases against former President Trump. The question before the Supreme Court was fairly simple and straightforward, albeit not as simple as it sounds. Is just plainly, does the president have any immunity to criminal prosecution? Or is he or she just like everybody else? And they can be criminally prosecuted if they break the law in whatever capacity. Former President Trump's team was arguing that he was absolutely protected in a particular case that he faces in a Washington, D.C. court. This is a federal court, the special prosecutor that's ahead of this case, Jack Smith. You'll recognize his name. He's also overseeing another case against former President Trump that has to do with classified documents. The case before this particular court centers around the 2020 election and activities before and after that election. The government, the Justice Department, is alleging that President Trump interfered, obstructed, was defrauding the American public. President Trump's team obviously denies this, but also says that the president should be protected from prosecution because if you open the presidency to criminal prosecution, that would have a chilling effect on the American presidency that would be negative for the American people. It's a broad summary, not only of just the case that's in front of all of us, but the two sides to this. So we finally got an answer today. And I want to get to that in just a moment. But before we do, you know, I like to start with a little conversation starters. And I just thought I'd start here because I feel like this will just bring the temperature down for all of us. Have you seen Beacon? Beacon is the new therapy dog for U.S. Olympic gymnastics. And Beacon actually has an amazing backstory because his owner, Tracy, her husband actually had to go through cancer treatment. And unfortunately, he lost his life during this period of time. There was a dog or one of his, a pet of his that was particularly helpful, Tracy says, during the treatments. And she was able to come by Beacon and raise him as a therapy dog. And this has been in many ways a tribute to her husband because she saw the benefit when he was going through something so challenging. And she wanted to make this available for others. And it's not very specific, at least some of the accounts that I read about how that conversation started between Tracy and the head of U.S. gymnastics. But obviously, U.S. gymnastics has gone through a lot of turmoil over the last several years, a lot of questions about not just the athlete's physical health, but their emotional, mental health, and safety as well. And so you may see on the sidelines during the Olympics, therapy dogs like Beacon, not just for U.S. gymnastics, but also for some of the other sports as well. As U.S. Olympics is trying to move towards how do we create a more healthy environment for our athletes. And so Beacon was actually on the sidelines of the Olympic trials this weekend, apparently came in handy for many of the athletes, some of who had a challenging time, some had to withdraw because of injuries, others, it's just a high stressful moment. And so those that advocate for therapy dogs says even just the simple action of petting a dog, like bring someone down to very normal behavior when they're in a very abnormal situation that helps recenter them. And so I think we should all get therapy dogs this year. That's really where I'm going with all of this. Number one, I want you to know, if you see a golden retriever on the sidelines with the U.S. Olympic teams, this is the reason why this is actually a thing that's taking place this Olympics. And I wanted you to see Beacon, who's described by USA Gymnastics as the goodest boy. He's 4 years old and he's already at the Olympics. So Beacon already making history. But I'm really thinking more seriously about this, about especially stressful periods, just because of the last several days, or really what we have in front of us with the election year. There is that thin kind of veil of stress. You know, different experts talk about, analysts talk about how election periods impact the public in ways that can be difficult to quantify, but are clearly there. For example, you know, if you work in real estate, people will say, well, a lot of people sit on the sidelines until after the election. Unless you really need to move, they're kind of waiting to see what happens. Even during election periods that are not so contentious like this particular one, there's still that feeling, oh, things kind of slow down a little bit, you know, or people are a little cautious. Big purchases slow down. People, they're not quite sure what to do. I'm curious if you feel that way in your life, if you feel kind of this little bit layer, I call that thin veil of stress. It's sort of sitting over everything. Maybe that's just me. Maybe we need a smarter puppy. My husband wants one. I have 3 young kids. I feel like we're a couple years away from that. Maybe I have to get through this election period too. See, it's a big purchase. I need some time. I can't go straight into that. So even if you do not have a goodest boy next to you, I feel like if we could just visualize a golden retriever next to us during these conversations where we're going to focus on really serious things, maybe that'll all just kind of recenter us and bring us back down. Lola is saying, we have a golden retriever named Bouncer. Great name. I love that. Dogs are the best. That's true. Amanda's saying, goldens are the goodest boys and girls. Our golden girl is so sweet. Great idea to have a therapy dog for Olympic athletes. I think it's a great idea too. What a simple solution. You know, we're always looking for solutions to really big problems. And obviously what U.S. gymnastics went through was a really big problem. They have a now convicted predator treating the young women of that team and causing such mental, physical, emotional anguish that we saw that play out not only in congressional testimony in front of the entire American public as these girls shared their stories, these young women, I should say now. We saw Simone Biles. This is part of the reason why she withdrew from the Olympics last time. It's just too much. So there are complicated stories that are in front of us. Maybe this is a reminder that sometimes this doesn't solve everything, but sometimes there is a simple solution that at least can be a move in the right direction. Maybe we should put it that way. Dogs for everybody in Congress, you know? There's always a controversy about the dogs at the White House. We're not even going to get into that. That comes up with every president, but maybe everybody needs a little bit of a puppy for Congress, a puppy for smarter news. All right, let's just get straight to it. Let's get into the Supreme Court decision. And I'm going to kind of give you a couple, kind of, broadly speaking, what this decision means for the American presidency and also for the particular case that is sitting in front of all of us regarding President Trump. The really big thing to remember about this decision is that the impact of it is not limited to the cases that we're seeing in front of us now. It is really establishing the first of its kind law or legal guidance for any sort of future cases that we could see. In 200 plus years, we haven't seen a former president criminally prosecuted or a current sitting president criminally prosecuted. So, could we see that again in the next 200 years? And this law, this body of law will be built upon, perhaps? Is this something that's very unique that we have this decision today? It's going to apply to a case that's in front of us, but whether or not it's applied again at some point in our lifetime, we don't know because we can't see the future. So as you see the headlines cross about this case, I think a couple things are important to know. There are more questions than answers about this decision. And any description of this as a loss or a win, we have to be really careful with because it's very nuanced. So again, we had both, and it's very unusual in this particular way for this case that we had both sides, not only the special counselor that's representing the Justice Department, but also President Trump's team wanting the Supreme Court to weigh in, wanting to answer this question about presidential immunity once and for all. And they wanted it essentially for different reasons. The special prosecutor wanted it because they needed to get an answer so that their case moves forward, and they wanted their case to move forward quickly for all sorts of reasons. You know, there's obviously a lot of talk about politics involved because it's an election year, but in general, they're ready to prosecute the case. They want to move it forward. President Trump's team doesn't want to see this case come to trial, and for any number of reasons, including the fact that the former president is running for re-election and we have an election in front of us, but also because they're standing their ground saying, this, there should be no foundation for this case. So really both sides are looking for the highest court in the land to provide some guidance on this. What's important to remember for the Supreme Court is the whole job of the Supreme Court is to look at the U.S. Constitution and apply it to issue decisions using the U.S. Constitution. They're the final word on this. The trouble is that the U.S. Constitution isn't very explicit about criminal prosecution of a president, if at all. So they don't really have the Constitution to rely on or look at different words or different phrases or different meanings or think about the time in which it was written. They're really looking at what's established by the Constitution and some previous decisions, but it's really their fresh interpretation and how it's going to be applied here. So overall, President Trump's team that was arguing that the president had absolute immunity lost in this decision. However, President Trump is celebrating this decision. So how can those two things be true? So let's get into that a little bit. Overall, we have a decision by the court that's 6-3. This will be described that the conservative justices, quote unquote, conservative justices ruled in favor of this particular decision, which was against former President Trump's legal team, but is also being viewed as a win in some ways. Again, we're going to get into that. You had the three, quote unquote, liberal justices with dissenting opinions. Now, I hate using those terms, conservative and liberal. None of these justices came forward and called themselves that. It's what the press has labeled them as, based on which presidents have nominated them. And if it was a Republican president, they would be called a conservative justice. If there was a Democratic president, they're going to be labeled a liberal justice. But the Supreme Court justices are not supposed to be political. They're going to have different interpretations of the law, and they're going to have a different record of ruling that could establish them as being more in line with conservative values that are held true or are prioritized, or in favor of more progressive viewpoints. But this is a media label for them, and I bristle at that. So I just want to state that clearly. That's why you're going to see that, but I don't love using that here. Now, in the decision, which was written by the Chief Justice. There are many opinions that are going to be issued in this decision. So you're going to have like the lead opinion that one of the justices is going to typically write, and you could have a couple consenting opinions with that. And then you could have the dissenting opinions as well. So the main opinion that basically explains the Supreme Court's decision on this was written by the Chief Justice John Roberts. And here's what he said, that the presidency does have some immunity. In fact, the term absolute immunity was used, absolute immunity for official acts while president, but no immunity for unofficial acts. So plainly speaking, if you're operating on behalf of the U.S. government in your role as president, you have immunity or presumed immunity for some of the activities that can take place. Now, you can see some questions in your mind about this. We're going to get into it. If it's an unofficial act, you're not acting as president, you're doing something wrong, you can be prosecuted. So then your question might be, well, okay, what's official and what's unofficial? And how do you solve that? What is official and what's not really official, sort of unofficial, and could be prosecuted? What are the different shades of gray here? And here's where the court doesn't really give an opinion. And the court says, that's not what we were asked. We're not asked to specifically weigh in on some of the allegations, for example, that are facing former President Trump. We're just here to kind of give parameters of what can be prosecuted and what can't. So in official duties, the president has protection. In unofficial duties, he does not. And where those official duties and unofficial duties overlap, that's for a judge to decide. Actually, the judges that are first looking at these cases. So in this particular case that we're looking at, in the Washington, D.C. court facing former President Trump, the Supreme Court basically is allowing this case to continue. The case can continue. President Trump does not have absolute immunity. But how this ruling will affect the prosecution against him is TBD, because a judge is going to have to decide on almost every issue, where does that line fall? Was that official duty or was that an unofficial duty? Let me show you an example of this. I pulled a couple different pieces from the case, decision for you. More than 100 pages long. We got through most of it. This just came out about two hours ago. And this is completely accessible if you'd like to see it. It's always available on supremecourt.gov. So let me pull this up so it's a little bit bigger so I can read it as we're going through it. This was a great example. So in this case that President Trump is facing in Washington, D.C., there's a question about how he behaved and how he behaved specifically with people that were outside of the Washington, D.C. circle or outside the Oval Office. So let me just read this part because this gets a little specific for the case that's in front of us now and kind of gives us a good idea of how this decision makes a decision, but leaves a lot to be desired about how this could be applied. I'm quoting here. The indictment's remaining allegations involving Trump's interactions with persons outside the executive branch, state officials, private parties, and the general public. In particular, the indictment alleges that Trump and his conspirators attempted to convince certain state officials that election fraud had tainted the popular vote count in their state, and thus electoral votes for Trump's opponent needed to be changed to electoral votes for Trump. After Trump failed to convince those officials to alter their state processes, he and his co-conspirators allegedly developed and effectuated a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceedings. Now, this is the part that gives us both sides. On Trump's view, the alleged conduct qualifies as official because it was undertaken to ensure the integrity and proper administration of the federal election. Trump's team is saying, hey, that falls within the parameters of him as president. He's looking over federal elections. This is his job. But the court goes on to say this. As the government sees it, however, Trump can point to no plausible source of authority enabling the president to take such actions. Determining whose characterizations may be correct and with respect to which conduct requires a fact-specific analysis of the indictment's extensive and interrelated allegations. The court accordingly remands to the district court to determine in the first instance whether Trump's conduct in this area qualifies as official or unofficial. This is a great example because already in some of our minds, right, you could say, wait a minute, that was not official conduct. And in others, you say, that was official conduct. So they're saying, yes, this is a very interesting question. And we're not going to answer it. We're going to push it down to the district court, and then the judge is going to make a decision. And then guess what's going to happen? Trump's team is going to appeal that decision if it's not in their favor. And the special prosecutor is going to appeal that decision if it's not in their favor. And then it's going to go to the appellate court, and then it's going to go to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court is going to have to rule on it, and it's going to come back to the courts. And you can see suddenly we're in a paperwork mess. Suddenly, we're in a legal maze of going through each of these allegations, wondering what's official, what's unofficial duties, can this actually be prosecuted or not? One of the things the Supreme Court did use as an example is they said that any sort of communication that President Trump had with the Justice Department, with his vice president, that's within official capacity, so that cannot be criminally prosecuted. And so that does put down a line for this prosecution of this case and future prosecutions to protect the presidency and give the president some immunity or absolute immunity in this case because it's during his official duties. So in some ways, the Supreme Court did put some parameters up and said, oh yeah, he's supposed to speak to the American people. He has to speak to the Justice Department. He's going to speak to his vice president. These are official duties. There's some other conversations he's having that we're not so sure. And if we're not so sure, then actually you didn't ask us to rule on that. So it's going to go down to the lower court. And here we are again. So the big takeaway from this also, when we looked at the case that's right in front of us, is that any sort of thought that this case is going to come to trial before the election is most certainly gone. And a question of when will this case ever be tried is a huge question mark because there's just a lot of things to go through. Unofficial, official, how do you argue it? We're going to make a decision. That's going to be challenged. Then we're going to go up and you can see how we're going to be hearing about this for a long time. Let me go ahead. I want to switch over to just this one part where Justice Roberts sort of summarized this in general. I'm going to read this to you too. I thought this was a really important paragraph understanding the Supreme Court's decision. He says this: the president enjoys no immunity for his unofficial acts, and not everything the president does is official. The president is not above the law, but Congress may not criminalize the president's conduct in carrying out the responsibilities of the executive branch under the Constitution. And the system of separated powers designed by the framers has always demanded an energetic, independent executive. The president, therefore, may not be prosecuted for exercising his core constitutional powers, and he is entitled, at minimum, to a presumptive immunity from prosecution for all his official acts. The immunity applies equally to all occupants of the Oval Office, regardless of politics, policy, or party. There you go. An energetic and independent executive. That's how they're looking at it. So that is the decision for now. And there's also an important point to bring up too when it comes to impeachment. Remember, the president does have, there is a way to hold the president accountable within the constraints of the government as it exists now, set up by the U.S. Constitution, and that is impeachment. So, for example, there is a belief that the president operated maybe not even illegally, but inappropriately in office. The barrier is much lower for impeachment. You don't have to break the law. You could do something that's just not considered good, that your fellow lawmakers are like, yeah, that's not, we don't like that. And you can see that perhaps in the in some of the arguments in recent history when it comes to impeachment. The House impeaches the president. The Senate is charged with convicting the president. The conviction can carry punishment, such as you are never allowed to run for elected office ever again. But if we're just looking at former President Trump, he was impeached by the House. There's a public admonishment of what he did. And then it moved over to the Senate. In both cases, the Senate did not convict the president. And there were no punishment because of that. So it is also important to remember that impeachment exists. So this idea that the presidency is completely without any checks of power when it comes to accountability is not correct, because we do see the Supreme Court saying, well, there is some room for criminal prosecution in some cases, but we're going to see how this develops and how other judges are going to rule on this depending on the scenario. And we're going to have to look through what's official and unofficial. And then also you have this path through Congress that exists within the U.S. Constitution. So I just want to make sure that we note that. The dissenting opinion by Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor is scathing. She was very upset. And I'm just using these words. I shouldn't even say very upset. I'm just by her the tone of this dissenting opinion and the words that she used, this is why I'm saying that. She's calling this decision by the Supreme Court deeply wrong and utterly indefensible. She's saying that basically the Supreme Court is making this up as they go along and not using foundational documents like the Constitution to make up their decision on this particular case. It's way too expansive, and her argument is can be applied too generally. And so I want to read you part of what she had to say. What's important with this dissenting opinion is that it doesn't necessarily have the weight of it's a matter of public record that the justice came out against this, and perhaps it could be used in different arguments to come. But the reality is the Supreme Court ruled in a different way than Justice Sotomayor. So this is more of a way for us to consider the alternate side to this argument. So here's what she says. The president of the United States is the most powerful person in the country and possibly the world. When he uses his official powers in any way under the majority's reasoning, he now will be insulated from criminal prosecution. Orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival, immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power, immune. Take a bribe in exchange for a pardon, immune. Immune, immune, immune. Let the president violate the law. Let him exploit the trappings of his office for personal gain. Let him use his official power for evil ends. Because if he knew that he may one day face liability for breaking the law, he might not be as bold and fearless as he would like as we would like him to be. That is the majority's message today. What she's saying there is that the majority said, listen, we have to give some protection to the president so that the president is able to act in a way that is putting the country first and is not worried constantly about criminal prosecution. And what's unsaid there is because of the politics of today and the politics that we've seen in the past, there's a question about could a president be criminally prosecuted because of political motivations. I mean, that's the argument from President Trump right now, that all of these prosecutions are politically motivated. So this is what the majority opinion was talking about, of saying, hey, we have to give some immunity to executive actions in official capacity. She's saying, hey, that's not good. That's going to give someone complete free rein. And she goes on to say this, even if these nightmare scenarios never play out, and I pray they never do, the damage has been done. The relationship between the president and the people he serves has shifted irrevocably. In every use of official power, the president is now king above the law. The majority's single-minded fixation on the president's need for boldness and dispatch ignores the countervailing need for accountability and restraint. She goes on, never in the history of our republic has a president had reason to believe that he would be immune from criminal prosecution if he used the trappings of his office to violate the criminal law. Moving forward, however, all former presidents will be cloaked in such immunity. If the occupant of that office misuses official power for personal gain, the criminal law that the rest of us must abide will not provide a backstop. With fear for our democracy, I dissent. So that's coming from Justice Sotomayor. I'm curious your thoughts on this, because that provides us these two different considerations, very different pictures. In both the argument is, in both of these opinions, you're seeing the argument being what's best for the American people and what's best for the presidency, which is something that the framers were very thoughtful about how they set up. What Sotomayor, I thought, was brought up a very interesting point. She said, in some cases, the Constitution does talk about what cannot be criminally prosecuted, and it doesn't say anything about the presidency. So it's her argument that that was intentional. And what you're seeing from the majority opinion is this feeling of the presidency needs to be protected from intrusion from other branches of government. And how do you do that in a way that's responsible? Yes, we're going to rule against former President Trump's argument here that he has complete immunity, but we agree that there's some immunity for actions taken while in office. This does leave a lot of unknown. You know, how does this apply? What about those examples that Sotomayor gave? Does that mean a president is completely protected from some decisions like that? How this ruling will be applied, we will only have to wait to see. We can't sort of hypothesize. We are going to see it applied to this particular case. What it means for the American presidency going forward is an unknown. And so we're left with some of that. I'm curious if anyone has any questions, and happy to take some of those from you as well. I know it's a big ruling. It's a lot to digest. And we had a question as well from Instagram. Wouldn't the impeachment process be what's utilized for the scenarios brought forward by the justice? Yes, the impeachment scenario could be. The question is about politics too. Remember, the impeachment offense, you need to have a certain barrier of votes within the House and the Senate. And depending on the politics at the time, if you had a president in office with a certain political affiliation and then the majority in the House and the Senate, impeachment is not going to be as frequent because the parties are supporting their party that also has the White House. Typically, if an action is so egregious that people have to vote for their integrity and their hearts over politics, of course, that's how impeachment would work. But it's not a court of law. It's not criminal prosecution. It's like a different category. And so if, let's say, there was a terrible scenario where the president did something horrible, I mean, I'm not going to use some of those examples. Let's just say the president robbed a bank as part of his official duties. I'm just making this up. And Congress is like, yeah, no, you're not. We're going to impeach you for that. Absolutely. And then we're going to convict you. We're going to remove you from office, and we're going to bar you from ever serving for office again. There's a question then, well, if he argues it's in official capacity, is he insulated from criminal prosecution in a regular court? So yes, he does that get that consequence from Congress, but then he still is protected from criminal prosecution like the rest of us. And wait, isn't everybody equal under the law in America? So it's a very interesting decision. And there's a lot of questions about how, again, it would be applied in the future. So I hope that gives you a good foundation for that. You're going to see a lot about this in the coming days or so, but it is such a complex and complicated ruling. I'm wondering if sort of the buzz over it sort of dies down, because we're going to have to wait to see how is this applied to this Washington, D.C. case, the federal case against former President Trump. Could that be, we're going to have legal minds. How is that going to be applied potentially to the classified document case in federal courts in Florida? What does that look like? And so it's going to take a little bit of time, unfortunately. I know in these atmospheres, we kind of want answers because there is so much unknown, isn't there? There's a lot of unknown. One thing that Clarence Thomas wrote a dissenting opinion, I just want to mention this because I saw some reports about this last week. And every once in a while, you see reports that catch your attention, but there's not really news. But I can start seeing, well, why are we suddenly getting Republicans to talk about whether or not a special counsel can actually lead these special investigations by the Justice Department? A special counsel has been used by the Justice Department for years. It's supposed to be someone in the cases of a particularly political case where the Justice Department can say, hey, we're going to appoint someone that is qualified, that is going to work in tandem. They're still part of the umbrella of the Justice Department, but they're working independently on this investigation because we believe that an independent viewpoint is important for keeping politics out of this case. Special prosecutors have been used for years. What Clarence Thomas brings up in his dissenting opinion is whether or not the special prosecutor role is one that was established by the U.S. Constitution. And if there is someone that has such power, whether or not their position should be approved of constitutionally or through Congress. And that's raising questions about should the special prosecutor, as we understand special prosecutors, exist in the way that the Justice Department has been appointing them? Whew. I don't know, guys. So that could lead to a whole other set of challenge. It leaves the door open for someone to say, well, should we challenge a special prosecutor being ahead of all of these cases? Or if a special prosecutor is appointed by a Justice Department, does it have to be approved through Congress? I mean, oof. I don't know. We could be talking about these cases. I could be an old lady with all my dogs at that point. I could have multiple therapy dogs. Maybe I'll have a whole like half dozen of them and probably some cats too. I don't know what else. And we could still be talking about this. I mean, one can only wish that we still are around for each other during that period of time. But this just opens the door. It just, as I started, this demands more questions than it gives answers. The winners and losers is in this not entirely clear. Yes, we have opinions where one could say, well, the American people have won because the Supreme Court is protecting the presidency in some cases, and allowing prosecution in others, and leaving courts to decide. And this is why judges really matter. And others to say, wow, this is like, as Justice Sotomayor say, well, wait a minute, this is leaving the door open for too many unknowns and we're not comfortable with it. So if there's any questions on this, I'm curious to answer them for you and keep them coming because it may take a little bit to process. I just want to finish up here quickly about what's going on with President Biden and the fallout from the debate, because we spent a little time on President Trump here just tangentially because of these cases. And, you know, one of the things that President Biden and President Trump have in common is that in both of their presidential campaigns, there's just been questions about whether or not they're going to continue for any number of reasons, whether or not it's questions about health capability or questions of prosecution. And there's been a lot of questions from you that are really good questions about, well, what would happen if a president decides not to run or his party suddenly loses confidence in him? How does that actually work? So let me just take this in two different parts because we're coming up the fallout from the debate last week. As you know, there was a lot of questions about President Biden's capabilities to continue in office now and also to serve in the future. These questions were coming from Democrats either on the record or not. Most of the more straightforward questions were coming from Democrat-aligned political analysts rather than Democrats that are currently in office or Democrat leadership. And we notice that because it's important to know who's on the record and who's not. But these questions have continued throughout the weekend. And although the president held a couple events, this did not quell whether or not he's fit for office, just plainly speaking. Yesterday, he was at Camp David with his family. And Camp David is a place that, you know, presidents get to go to take a little time away. This is where he was preparing for the debate as well. And according to reports, again, from unnamed sources, the family and the president continue to discuss the future of his race for the presidency for a second term. The early report suggests that he will continue to stay in the race. But I between us, I've seen a lot of this before, and we could get reports that he is staying in the race until we get that announcement. We get 30 minutes heads up that he's going to go live somewhere and withdraw. So who knows what's going to happen? We really don't. And all this flurry of unnamed sources presents a little bit of a problem about actually what's taking place. So as of right now, he has no public events on his calendar. He's still at Camp David today on Monday, and he'll continue there and only come back to the White House on Tuesday. On Monday night, and we'll only see him at the White House on Tuesday. According to the established schedule, we only get the schedule like a day or two in advance, so we don't really know what the rest of the week is going to look like. That's all we know right now. What we were watching for this weekend is who's speaking on the record and what are they saying. So I just want to share two different sound bites, very different perspectives from two different types of lawmakers. And that way you can just hear what is some of the conversation from people on the record about the president. Here's the first one. This is Congressman Raskin. He's a Democrat who serves in the House, and he was speaking on MSNBC.
The one that John Allen was talking about. The discussions around the future of the Democratic Party with Joe Biden as the presidential candidate. You are a thinker. Our viewers respect you as such. Tell me your thinking.
Well, I mean, this is what a real political party looks like, and this is what a real political party does. But obviously, there was a big problem with Joe Biden's debate performance, and there's also just a tremendous reservoir of affection and love for Joe Biden in our party. And so this makes it a difficult situation for everybody, but there are very honest and serious and rigorous conversations taking place at every level of our party, because it is a political party and we have differences of point of view. I mean, if you compare that to the non-existent dialogue and conversation that took place in the Republican Party after Donald Trump's criminal conviction on 34 counts, it's remarkable. And so we're having a serious conversation about what to do. Well, one thing I can tell you is that regardless of what President Biden decides, our party is going to be unified, and our party also needs him at the very center of our deliberations and our campaign. And so whether he's the candidate or someone else is the candidate, he is going to be the keynote speaker at our convention. He will be the figure that we rally around to move forward and beat the forces of authoritarianism and reaction in the country.
So you kind of had to follow along with that, right? At the very end, it was like, well, we're going through this very honest conversation. We're having an assessment, and he will be at the convention, whether or not as a candidate. Sorry, kind of threw that in there. That was the most direct that we saw. So we wanted to make sure that you saw it too. Now here is Senator Warnock from Georgia, and he's speaking to Kristen Welker also on NBC.
Do you think President Biden should drop out of this race, Senator?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, they say if it's Sunday morning, it's meet the press. I'll tell you, as a pastor, it's for me, it's church time. And I can tell you that there have been more than a few Sundays when I wish I had preached a better sermon. But after the sermon was over, it was my job to embody the message, to show up for the people that I serve. And that's what Joe Biden has been doing his entire life of public service. And over the last 4 years, he's been showing up for the American people. He's been showing up for seniors as they've been dealing with the rising cost of prescription drugs, of having to choose between buying food and buying medicine in the wealthiest nation on the planet. He's been showing up for workers. He's been showing up for folks who, chasing the American dream, found themselves mired in student debt, a kind of government-sanctioned debt trap. And he found a way, while being resisted by Trump's allies, to forgive that debt and give people a fighting chance. The question this morning is not what is Joe Biden going to do. The question is, who has Donald Trump ever shown up for other than himself and people like himself? I'm with Joe Biden, and it's our assignment to make sure that he gets over the finish line come November, not for his sake, but for the country's sake.
Senator, I hear you saying, look, this was a bad performance, but a lot of Democrats are saying, boy, it was more than that. It raised real concerns about his readiness, his ability to serve another 4 years. What was your reaction when you saw him struggling to complete sentences?
Well, listen, if they weren't engaged in a little bit of hand-wringing, they wouldn't be Democrats.
I mean, what a great line. Senator Warnock on message, using the Sunday example, and I don't know how many of us were sitting there like, oh yeah, every once in a while that Sunday sermon doesn't hit quite right. You know, this has been the line. The reason why I wanted you to see it is that it's smooth. He uses an example that people understand, that people have bad days, but our job is to continue serving. Here's the way that we're continue serving. One of the ways that he comes back at Kristen Welker here is he says, well, you know, Trump's a liar. He goes into that. So you see this defense of Joe Biden is continuing. There's a little bit of room by Jamie Raskin there, the congressman, a little bit of room. But overall, what you're seeing from Senator Warnock continues in complete defense of the president. It was a bad night. What's the next goal? Look at his record. We're not abandoning him. Now, what you're hearing off the record is something different. And what you're hearing from political pundits is something different. And right now, what we're going to have to shake out is what's actually real. Here's something that is real. In order for any president right now, any presidential candidate right now to suddenly disappear from the race, you know, suddenly resign from the role as presidential candidate, it really has to be their choice. However, political conventions do leave some room for the party to make a call. Why is it that a presidential candidate has to make that decision? Why do we continue to hear, well, this is President Biden's, his decision and his family's alone? Why do we continue to hear that? Isn't it more? Isn't it his team? Isn't it the White House? Isn't it his campaign managers? It's not just up to him, right? What is up to him in this way? Voters across America chose him in the primaries. He has been elected essentially as the presidential candidate, as has President Trump, both for their opposing parties. And so we picked these guys. And so in order for them to suddenly not be the candidate anymore, it would take an extraordinary event, something I don't want to even get into different scenarios, an extraordinary event that has to do with health or ability to serve. It would have to take them stepping back and saying they're no longer running. And in some case, it could be that there's a call made by a political party in their convention. And I wanted to show you this. I stumbled upon this article. I actually would really love to interview this person, Edward Acorn. He wrote for the Wall Street Journal, "Could a Brokered Convention Replace President Biden?" And he wrote this in March. So this isn't anything that's recent. And it's part of the reason why I liked it. He's a newspaper journalist for 4 decades, Edward Acorn, and he's the author of The Lincoln Miracle: Inside the Republican Convention That Changed History. So here's a fun fact that you can tell your friends. You want to know who became president because of a brokered convention or a contested convention? President Lincoln. There was a real question about who the Republicans were putting forward in this year that Lincoln was elected. And there was a lot of concern about this man, William Seward. He was the former New York governor. He was a U.S. senator at the time. And there was just a concern about his policy stance, and I'm just using that generally, by a lot of the Republicans. And at this time, according to this account, candidates did not attend the convention. So unlike what we're seeing now, they didn't actually go and make speeches. It was for the party officials to do that. And so Lincoln, according to reports, according to the reporting, said to his team, "I'm not agreeing to anything. Don't put anything forward. I'm not doing that." Lincoln tried to run for president, and he wasn't approved, right? And so his team was going there to still represent him, but they already had a candidate. But there were agreements that were made between different representatives of this political party, of the Republicans at the time. And as the convention comes to a close, Lincoln is suddenly the candidate. He goes on to become one of the greatest presidents in American history. But he got to that nomination through the convention. So it's an interesting little fact to know about as you're having conversations with friends and family about like what could happen in this campaign. There's so much unknowns. Well, this is an example of going into the convention thinking there was one candidate that was coming out on top and another one comes out. But it takes extraordinary effort. I want to go ahead and go back to this article. And again, this is written in March. So it gives us some perspective. This is what's written. Quote, were President Biden to step aside, delegates would be free to choose another candidate at the convention. The winner under party rules would need 50% of the votes plus one. But Democrats could ill afford the division and hurt feelings spawned by a convention brawl less than 3 months before a general election. Party leaders would surely settle on a new candidate before the convention opened, as well as a new playbook for the delegates who tend to represent important special interests, particularly teachers' unions, and are intensely loyal to the party. What about Republicans? Could a successful prosecution and jailing at President Trump opened the door to a battle on the convention floor in Milwaukee. That seems almost impossible, given that Trump now dominates the Republican Party. His legal challenges, which he insists are politically motivated, have, if anything, enhanced his popularity with the base. In any event, it seems increasingly unlikely that prosecutions could be wrapped up by the start of the convention on July 15th, which is correct. As Abraham Lincoln's election shows, miracles can happen in American politics. A contested convention would be a political junkie's ultimate high, but such a contest seems doubtful, even in this political cycle, arguably one of the strangest in American history. I have to reach out to Edward. I'm like, we got to get you on Smarter News. I want to hear more about this convention that got Abraham Lincoln to become president. And also, you know, what about these different scenarios that could come forward? It is a really interesting point that while we're hearing different names, even in all of the murmurs and whispers and talk and gossip, you know, it could be Kamala Harris, could be Gavin Newsom, could be Gretchen Whitmer, like who are the potential names in the Democrat Party that could step forward? Well, what happens if at a convention, the Democrats are not in line, if this scenario comes up, and then there's actually a fight between Democrats about who represents the party? What if the same thing happens with Republicans? The Republicans and the Democrats don't look unified, and therefore the American public completely loses faith, and that impacts the election over who's actually being put forward. So important takeaways from that really are that this is why there's a lot of focus on the president and his decision about what this campaign looks like going forward, and why they will also be the same focus on President Trump. And by the way, that focus is going to come right back to President Trump on July 11th? I'm picking that out of thin air, when the sentencing takes place for his criminal case in New York, where he was convicted of crimes in that state. And he could be behind bars. He could actually be serving a sentence, a jail sentence, for the next several weeks ahead of the election. I mean, this is really remarkable and very historic, it's accurate. It's not hyperbole. So these questions are going to come up for both Democrats and Republicans. We're hyper-focused on the Democrats right now. It's going to come right back to the Republicans as we get through the July 4th holiday. So here we are. I look forward to your questions, and I will make sure to take them and answer them and keep you posted as we do. One of you is commenting, I don't think Seward had a majority of delegates before the election. We're talking about that case at the particular convention where Abraham Lincoln was nominated. That may not be the case. We'll have to look more into that. And that's why I'd love to have that journalist on to talk about something I never heard about before, which is how Abraham Lincoln actually got the nomination. Because really, what do we focus on? What he did in office and his upbringing. But there's that big period in between where politically he wasn't that successful. It's a very interesting lesson. And as Edward said in that piece, you know, miracles can happen. So while we entertain, we're always about both sides of the story, or three sides or four sides or five sides. While we entertain different sides that can give us anxiety, we also have to entertain the possibility that we're on a path to something better. And this is just this time period of working through that so we can get to that next stage. And that's what I'll continue to have optimism for. So just keep that in mind. Keep that in your back pocket. Also, just want to leave you with this quick thought. As we've been through a lot of very tough stuff, and there's a natural inclination to continue to watch the play-by-play in politics. How could we not? And also, what's the news development? What's the president's going to say next? What's President Trump going to say? What is going on? I know it as much as anybody else. It's so hard to take a break. One of the things I just posted on social media today is a short video. I was reading in for Smarter News, as I typically do on a Sunday, and I was looking at these stories of these incredible athletes. How remarkable, during an election year, we actually have the Olympics. That always inspires and gives us hope about how remarkable humanity is at a time when sometimes we have our doubts when we look at politics. And so the lesson I saw was, you know, Simone Biles, arguably the greatest gymnast in history, took a break. She took a break by choice during the last Olympics where she said, I'm done. I'm going to need to walk away for a little bit. I got to get myself together. I'm not able to perform mentally, emotionally, physically. I'm going to take some time away from the sport. And there was a big question about whether or not she was going to come back. You know, was this the end of her career where she withdraws from the Olympics? Simone Manuel, a swimmer who's a historic swimmer because of her performance at two different Olympic Games, she had the same thing where she had to take a step back. Doctors diagnosed her with overtraining syndrome, and she had to basically not swim, not do any physical activity. She was forced to rest. And there was all those questions. Is she going to retire? How does she come back? And for both of these women, both named Simone just by coincidence, they both recalibrated and came back to compete better than ever. Both of them are headed back to the Olympics. And they had this period of rest by choice or by force, or what they had to make that very difficult decision for themselves. They had to rest. And by resting, they were able to reattack. And so I want to share that with you today at a time where it's very difficult to rest. I'm sure it's hard for many of us for different reasons, whether it's work, parenting, the media, social media. It's hard to take a step back. We can look at these two incredible examples of American women, high-performing athletes, the best that are out there, and look that they rested, and that's exactly what they needed to be better than ever. So I'm going to try to take that lesson going into July 4th. We're going to try to pull back a little bit just so that we can also take a deep breath at Smarter News and be ready to reattack. Because as we come back from that July 4th weekend, we're going to be right back into the swing of things with the sentencing for President Trump, going into the party conventions, and surely more developing stories to cover. So thank you for being here. We hope you get some rest over the Independence Day holiday and you have some time to reflect on how remarkable and amazing America is. And we're one of those countries where we fight out loud and we fight in person, and we are always redefining what freedom and liberty looks like each generation. But it's our freedoms that allow us to do that in a way that sometimes can feel overpowering, but also is almost like an honest display of fighting not behind closed doors, but really having that tension of what does liberty look like out in the public space. And so while there's been all these questions about what do other countries think about us, well, we are the freest country in the world. And so part of that is that what is going on is out for everybody to see for the most part. And so we can celebrate that too and appreciate it at a time when sometimes it doesn't feel that great. And that's what I'm going to be thinking about. So a lot of fun facts coming your way on July 4th on smarternews.com and throughout our social media channels. Keep your questions coming. And I look forward to answering them as they come up. And as we learn more, the fallout of the Supreme Court decision and also about what's going on with the elections here at home, we want to be here for you for quick, concise, nonpartisan information. And we look forward to being together through this developing story during this chapter and others. So have a great Happy July 4th. I'll be on all our social media channels and I'll see you there. And if you have any questions and concerns, you can always reach us at scoop@smarternews.com or hello@smarternews.com. All right, guys, have a great Independence Day. Celebrate your liberty however you see fit within within parameters. All right. I can't have any of the Smarter News folks becoming a story. We can watch the stories. We can cover them together. Take it easy out there. All right. Have a peaceful, beautiful, love-filled, liberty-celebrating July 4th. And we'll be back here next week with more. All right, guys, have a great day. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan Smarter News. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news. And we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.